The Grade Cricketer is a Twitter stream. It's about playing cricket at the grade level.
It's a tough, mean, dirty, dirty business being a grade cricketer.
A lot of cricketers, you know, that's all they know. They've done it since they're 10 and they have a deep-seated fear of change.
But the grade cricket is all about being the most alpha version of yourself as possible, at all costs and at all times.
I don't bat or bowl. I just feel the gully, count the number of dot balls in a row, sledge 15-year-olds, make me feel better about myself.
Thanks champ.
Oh, no, you called me champ.
Hello and welcome to the Great Cricketer Podcast on Fox Sports. It's a terrific show this week. The Shield, the second round of the Shield, Mitchell Starc taking hat-tricks everywhere. England have landed, they've started playing cricket, and they've also got some rules for boozing. Adam Collins is on the show, and Pez has done a very special one-on-one with friend of the show Daniel Norcross, all about English cricket, because we need to know everything about England. Always know your opposition. I've always said that. Hashtag AskTGC, and we've got a very special product that we're going to launch this week. TGC, the new cologne by TGC. My name is Ian Higgins. I'm joined by Dave Edwards and Sam Perry. Lads, fourth one of the summer. Here we are. We've made it. And it's a step closer to the first test match at the Gabba.
Very good. Here goes. Yeah, very much so. Hello and welcome to everybody out there. It's just, I mean, again, an inspiring introduction from you. Here goes, making cricket sound interesting. I do feel like it's just been another week where we're just waiting for the Ashes to start, aren't we? And just inventing narrative, to use that word, that cliche classic narrative. We were just sort of watching the Australian players, seeing how they were going this week. They're all doing fairly well, aren't they? I mean, we're none the wiser as to the major question, which is who will be 6 and 7. I don't even know if we want to go over it because it's so boring. You know, you had like Warner's untouchable in the side. He'll play. Khawaja's already hit a ton. Same goes Smith. Hanscom's got a daddy 50 or two. Maxwell got 260s, then there's nothing, and then Cummins, Starkline and Hazelwood, you know, are already a lock and dominating opposition. Looks like Wade is gone from the side. He's really struggling, and the Renshaw situation labours on because he doesn't have levers. We already talked about that. I wanted to say, it's kind of like, it must be hard for the Australian players going into these Shield matches because it's almost like they're like reapplying for their jobs. Do you know what I mean? They're having to, they've got these good CVs and whatever, but they have to put their CVs in again, and then there's all these other CVs coming into the side. You know, like Sean Marsh, for example, he puts his CV in every week, and it's like he got a really great mark in the HSC as a kid. Like he's sort of 99.94 HSC, whatever equivalent of like a school leaving mark was. Yeah. But he hasn't been able to hold down a job since.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good analogy, Pez. It is a little bit like, you know, if you work at a satellite office and your boss from overseas, the big dog in like the US or the European headquarters, comes over for like a week and he just hangs out in your office. And he's not doing much, is he? So, you know, he's kind of hanging around. You're getting your work done. You're just going by your day-to-day. And the big dog is just, he's in your team. He's in your office. He's next to you. He's using his laptop. He's asking you what the Wi-Fi code is. Suddenly you're on his level. And I think that's a little bit like what it's like playing with a test player if you're a Shield bloke. But there's a lot of them floating around. There's been a lot of narratives to draw upon, not just for us, but you know, any kind of cricket pundit going around. And I think the biggest thing over the last day or so was probably the Starc double hat-trick. Two hat-tricks in one game. I mean, guys, we've been talking about how this summer is just going to be alpha, 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 but that is a very, very, very ominous warning to England's lower order, isn't it? Maybe not the real batsman, but certainly for the lower order batsman.
there is something wonderful about having Mitchell Starc who can just clean up a tail. I think that's what Mitchell Johnson did so well in the last Ashes series that was in Australia, is that the tail really didn't wag at all and it wasn't allowed to wag. And when you've got a guy who's skilled as Mitchell Starc bowling around the wicket, that sort of reverse swinging, attacking the stumps, LBs and bowls into the equation, like guys like Stuart Broad, who has no doubt lost his batting ability in some respects pretty much ever since he got hit in the head, I think it was by against Pakistan. Like he's really struggled to score runs, but he's still a dangerous guy who can score 40, 50, 60s quickly. Yep. But when you get Starc, who can throw in a bumper, then throw in a, you know, reverse swing Yorker, I don't fancy the likes of even as high as Wokes down to Anderson scoring many runs when Stark's got his tail up. The double hat-trick, though, apparently it's only ever happened 7 times in the history of professional cricket before Mitchell Starc did it on or during the week. So that is, I guess we've seen history.
It's funny. I mean, there's something about this Sheffield Shield season or the first two games that are just throwing up narratives that are ending up becoming like people's worry about the whole Ashes series. So Stark did nothing the week before, really. Oh, actually, wait. He got 8-4. but compared nothing. To a double hat-trick, that's nothing. But this week it was Jake Lehman scoring 100 or a 90. Like, there's never been a better time to get a spot in the Australian batting lineup. Like, you make one or two scores and your name is up in lights. I mean, particularly helpful for him, given his last name is Lehman, and he seems to have all the affect of his dad, which endears into me greatly. I mean, a lot of people on the like the TGC Twitter line, Facebook line, have asked us for our views on Lehman, Jake, that is, in the Australian side in relation to his dad. Do we have any views on that?
I'm not sure I've got any strong views about the Darren Lehman, Jake Lehman situation, other than just doesn't Australia just love a bolter? Like, and this is like these three Shield games, you know, the story has quickly gone from how come our best players, you know, Klinger, White, Cowan, et cetera, aren't playing, to all of a sudden, who's the wicketkeeper bolter? You know, like Cameron Bancroft all of a sudden is in the picture. Mm-hmm. Even like Carey was like the third choice. You know, Tim Payne, possibly the best gloveman of the country, standing at first slip to Matthew Wade, who's looks like he's no chance. But now Jake Lehman, like, I recognise his name. Yeah. Therefore, that helps me immediately. I don't have to learn a new player's name. I recognise the name. Mm. And we just love a bolter, just someone out of nowhere, someone we can get behind because we think that, like, well, if I've never heard of this bloke, that means that could be me.
Well, it takes the effort off you having to do research on his career and, you know, go trawl through his statistics over the last few years or something. If he just does something in the immediate week leading up to the Ashes, then you can kind of hinge everything on him. But I think on the Jake Lehman thing, my only real opinion on that is if he plays for Australia under his dad, then we'll probably have another 10 years of dad joke material and probably another two or three books in us.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and then that's why we're commencing our campaign to get Jake Lehman into the side for business purposes purely. I do like the idea that name recognition really helps people get into the side. It's like quite, it's a bit of a political communication concept as well. It's like Tony Abbott with Stop the Boats, etc. Just Jake Lehman messaging immediately around. Makes you think of Darren and therefore his prospects have inflated greatly.
So I wonder, chaps, I mean, Callum Ferguson scored 180. Now some of the fans out there will recognise Callum Ferguson. I sort of remember that name. He did play one test match for Australia once, and you're probably thinking, was that in the mid-90s when Gavin Robinson played? And no, actually it wasn't. He played one test match last summer against South Africa in a day-night test match. No, he played in the Hobart test match, wasn't it, when we got bowled for 7-30 against Rabada. Yeah, and to be fair, Cal Ferguson did run himself out in the second innings. I think it was the second innings, but so he was picked as like a guy who could have made it. He could have gone on to be our next, you know, number 4, 5, 6 in the middle order, but he wasn't ready. Now he's just scored 180, but he had a go, so he can't be picked again.
He was the unlucky fall guy last year, wasn't he? I mean, we had that emotional, shocking collapse, which I'm only just recovering from. I don't know about you guys, but look, Ferguson's been around for a long time, and if we're looking at guys, bolters, as you say, he goes like Lehman and Bancroft, we probably need to take another look at Ferguson because he has done his time. Granted, he's not an alpha dog. He's more of a proper batsman, which is ultimately to his detriment given Australia's obsession with picking muscle-bound Adonises at number 6, which can... You know, the kind of guys that can pump maximums at will. We actually wrote about this in our weekly article for Fox Sports this week about how we are having some issues with the number 6 batsman. That batsman now is kind of lacking an identity. Number three is the best batsman. Number 4 is the most elegant. Number 5 is the best against spin. No kid wants to be a number 6, so we've been struggling to fill that role for a very long time.
The Ferguson situation is a particularly interesting one. And he goes, I'm reminded of what you were just saying before. So he got run out in very dubious and kind of like alarming, frightening circumstances last year. And then went made 180 the other day. But does the run out loom larger in our memory than the 180? Probably. Mm-hmm. And in that vein, Dave, you were talking about identity at number 6. Like, I noted, he goes, when you were talking, you stopped referring to him as Callum Ferguson and you started referring to him as Cal. And I think this has been a little bit of a brand shift for him. I've noticed in the last year or two, he's become Cal Ferguson, right. And like, yeah. And full credit to him because he's had to move away from the identity as this sort of spindly, wiry, proper batsman to something, to a name that resembles more someone who would lift, you know,
yeah.
copious weights at Muscle Beach.
Well, it's funny,
he's Cal now
because Callum is quite contemporary name. Like, I'm probably, you know, without checking the stats, it's probably in the top 100 names for boys in 2017. So I think that Cal is certainly he's in need of a brand shift though, isn't he? I'm getting the wrap up for some reason.
I think I think he's definitely going through some sort of midlife crisis. You know, some guys buy leather jackets, other guys shorten their name to three letters, says Ian Higgins. Boys, England, they're playing cricket. They're playing cricket at the moment. And that's can we take much away from them playing against the Waxy, the WA 11? It was like almost like a second 11. I recognise one name from, speaking of recognising names, I recognise one name, Coulton Isle, who snicked off Alistair Cook's second ball of the match. But I recognise someone. England playing cricket, anything to take away?
Yeah, I mean, Cook failed second ball, therefore that's what's going to happen to him all series. I mean, that's really the rhythm of the media in the lead-up to the Ashes. Whatever happens in 1 week will therefore happen for the rest. having said that, as we go to where he did fail again against Caxi, so I don't know. You know, Anderson got four for. Yeah. I think Stuart Gaud got kind of pumped, and Mason Crane got some wickets. So therefore, that's what's going to happen all series.
Is it hard to read into the results of a tour match? Do we still kind of do that? I'm sure it's like kind of like the old days when Bradman and co would land in England, and they'd probably have like 60 tour games before they even had the first test. And I guess people watched that closely and studied his form and so forth. But if Cook snicked off twice in two innings, then you know he's absolutely rubbish, isn't he?
Alarm bells are ringing. I mean, I'd say he's in the same scenario, as in the same boat as Renshaw now. Two failures and, you know, who's going to come in? Maybe James Vince comes in for him.
I think the tour games, like, I think it was Bairstow and someone else retired, like, at lunch, and then they gave, like, Vince and Overton a turn to have a hit. So it's like, you know, I think, you know, we can only take so much away from what happens in that game. It's also, I find it weird that we like, the Australian people have just put them on the whacker first up. We're going to bump you from day one, you blokes.
Yeah. They've never played on a hard wicket ever. We just assume that of English people. Like, he has toured here at least five or six times.
Get off the front door.
It is fun in this like commercial age to read between the lines of why teams have been put on particular grounds. Like you said that about the whacker, and then you know, England have played against a WA second 11 basically, while the New South Wales team, which we all understand on this show is the Australian team, played against the actual WA side. And then going into the first test, New South Wales will play against Queensland on the Gabba. Interesting, given the first test is at the Gabba. You know, all these little advantages. Like, we cry foul so much whenever we go to India or any other country about how unfair it is. And we do the same thing and just turn a blind eye to it. Actually, we find it funny and it makes us happy.
Yeah.
Yeah, but what about the time Stuart Broad didn't walk? So anyway, there's been some rules come out of England today. Some rules come out of England today, just like this is a Commonwealth country.
They passed some laws.
They don't mind the rules.
And, you know, Commonwealth government means that we have to take them on as well. Rules for boozing. Who knows about this? Who knows about rules for boozing on the England tour?
Well, our good friend of the show, Brett Jeeves, wrote a piece recently around some... it seemed like a bit of a PR thing. He goes that there was information released to the media and therefore the public about England's senior players or their team having established some light rules around their boozing culture or what they will and won't do with boozing. And it really amounted to just this common sense approach, almost as though they just decide, look, we need to let people know that, we're going to be having drinks, but, you know, not too much. And Trevor Bayliss, who's their coach, the Australian coach, he kind of came in on a bit of a mandate to like chill out a little bit because their previous coach, Andy Flower, why are you guys laughing at my like slowing
just,
down
just
and speeding up?
A few drinks, but not too much.
Not too much. Not too much. Yeah. Not too much.
It's the kind of thing you say at the office. Sorry. Like, well, I'm just going to go out for one or two, but not too much.
Have some milk, line your stomach.
That's kind of like their policy. And Trevor Bayliss came in on a mandate of like chilling out a little bit because Andy Flower was like a really hardline military guy.
Yeah.
It was just strange. And then Brett Jeeves wrote this piece about just the uneasy relationship between alcohol and cricket. Like, you can't even if it is a light approach, you can't really tell adults what they can and can't do when it comes to drinks and alcohol. Mm. And I thought, you know, that just was right in our wheelhouse about cricket and alcohol. I mean, did you guys in your playing careers ever have a relationship between the two?
Of course, Pez. I mean, you still remind me occasionally of the one time I turned up to a PGs game in a cricket vest with a huge wine stain on it. I'd been at a house party.
You beat me. The night you've before. Beaten me to the punch.
Yeah. I think I was at a house party the night before, dressed as a cricketer, and obviously at some point I'd knocked a glass of wine on myself. So turning up with that vest probably, well, it earned me a great deal of social capital. Hopefully with yourself and maybe with some of the other cricketers that I played with. In retrospect, it was probably a cry for help.
Both is possible. Both are possible. Well, yeah, you were standing in front of the Pratton Park scoreboard before an under 21s match on Sunday,
yeah,
where people do traditionally turn up drunk, but it was raining, so there was a real like bleakness to the day. And we turned up. You were sort of there early, which is odd for you. And we're all kind of crowded around you. You were holding court,
yeah,
as the like whether it was the Chop King or otherwise, but also because you were just sort of this tall figure with nothing but a vest on, like a sleeveless vest, with your arms coming out, yeah, and a huge red wine stain on your North Sydney vest. Like, we're all told to turn up in our tracksuits and a proper, yeah, club kit, and you just had shorts, thongs, and a vest.
Well, I was one of the older players, Pez, in the under 21s team, so I was obviously setting an example for the young kids, as you do when you're the elder statesman. I mean, the reason I used to drink before games was to have a ready-made excuse in the event that I failed. It's a protective mechanism. I mean, I think any self-respecting grade cricketer with an alcohol problem would say the same.
There's some sort of delicious irony, Edo, is about you dressing at a party as the cricketer. Like, this is probably like 7 years before you became part of the grade cricketer.
I was always very self-aware, even in PGs.
I like the idea that the cricketer is like this novel image as well, like this novel character, yeah, like as if you'd be a cricketer. No. I'll go as a cricketer to a Halloween party.
Yeah. Other people went and were like, it's Andy Warhol. I just thought it was the cricketer.
It's very postmodern.
A guy that I used to play with always used to say light beers after 2 a.m., which is a message that I've carried on ever since. So that's actually a good one for the kids out there. If you are going to drink on a Friday night, yeah, light beers after 2 a.m.
Yeah.
Chaps, just one more thing before we get to Adam Collins to talk seriously about cricket for just a wee moment. Ashes Cricket on PlayStation and Xbox, I presume, and all high-definition computer games. That just dated me, didn't it?
Going well till then.
On a floppy disk. Yeah, it was going. Yeah, everything was going well. Not my own life, just this monologue. Ashes Cricket. Are you guys excited to be playing cricket games on computer games?
Cricket games on computer games.
You're only 31. Like, how have you just got no idea about technology?
I like the use of the term computer. I try and use it more these days. Yeah. Am I excited? No, not at all. I don't play computer games mainly because it's kind of like gambling. It's mainly because I'm scared that I'll just want to do it all the time. Mm-hmm. But I just use alcohol for that. But it's always fun to see a cricket game, like a game that you like,
yeah,
with some really like high definition graphics and stuff. But you know that the trailers always look better than the actual gameplay. And speaking to some people, I mean, this actually isn't an ad placement in case anyone's listening at all. But speaking to people who have reviewed the game, they get really serious about the like real lifelike qualities of the game, like computer games. God, what's the other word for computer games?
Video games.
You don't need another. Just go with that one.
Yeah. Okay. The thing with computer games these days is like they have such a lifelike quality to them. Yeah. And like someone was telling me about like, you know, those shoot 'em up games are like so lifelike these days it's even hard to distinguish from reality, and FIFA's the same as that as well. Like in these shooter games, there's this one where you can like find a dog or something and start petting the dog and taking the dog around with you, and it becomes just like everyday life. So I figured if the Ashes game is only about playing cricket, then it's not really capturing the whole essence of what it means to play cricket.
No.
And I'd want to know whether that Ashes game could actually, like if there could be a cricket game that actually simulates real life cricket. you know, like, you know, playing, going through grade cricket, going through junior cricket, you know, can you have a video game where you can go through junior cricket, be given out by dads, you know, that hate you because you're sort of half decent and they don't know the rules of LBW and, you know, how you deal with that? Or like, you've got to wash, you know, do you wash your whites the night before and turn up without like clean whites and get sledged by people? You know what I mean? Like, yeah. Did you put petrol in your car? Do you have to organize a lift? Like, I'd buy the shit out of that game.
Yeah, I'd buy the game that is all about everything except the actual playing of it. Like, so I don't actually want to, like, you know, press enter to hit the ball or anything. I don't want any game related experience. Enter. I just want the whole social dynamics experience, you know, through a computer game. If you can make something like that, then I'm interested. But I've got no interest. I mean, for me, the last computer game I played was Cricket 96, and that was probably as close as it got to real life, because I remember the commentators were talking about things like divorce and alimony payments.
Yeah.
So that was probably actually ahead of its time in terms of computer games, in that it kind of cusped on real life cricketing experiences. I was an 11-year-old boy playing that, so it was a little bit interesting at the time, but it stuck with me.
Yeah, I didn't know what alimony meant either, but looking back, it was bang on, because it's really just about child support payments and stuff. So I don't know who they were referencing, but I did like it.
Yeah.
Are they getting, is Cricket 96, the producers who made that show, are they getting royalties from our book? Because it feels like from a young age that was ingrained in our brain. But I mean, obviously there's people screaming at their podcast devices as we speak, because everyone knows that the greatest cricket game ever was Shane Warne Cricket 99, or Brian Lara Cricket 99 if you're from the UK. That was without a doubt the greatest cricket game of all time.
It was the same product, wasn't it? It was a white label product. So they just put the, like, Brian Lara and Shane Warne, they just put their names to it, and there was some gentle tweaks done. They weren't separate games, were they? That was a misconception.
Yeah.
No, it was white label.
It was white label. White label is a great term, yeah. It was a white label product.
It was a white label product.
I just quickly want to go back, Higos, if that's possible, to,
of course,
the sort of things you'd like to see in a cricket game. Yeah. Like, I'd like to, you know, career mode, really, because they have this for FIFA. You know, nets Tuesday, Thursday, which net do you get in? You know, can you avoid the fast bowler, you know, in the first net? Like, I'd really play that. You know, do you drink the night before, or do you take the Pepsi challenge? And if so, then how you manage yourself on the circuit, you know?
There's a similar type of thing in, like, the 2K franchise. I mean, we're obviously NBA fans here on this podcast, but, like, the NBA 2K franchise, where, like, the player mode has to, like, get out of the streets, basically. And this is very much the same thing, except you've basically got to get out of your own head. You know, you've got to get out of your own thoughts.
Yeah.
And then you basically, like, I think beating the game is you stop playing. That's when you win.
Yeah. Well, you play the boss level, like the last thing is you just come up against the club president and just say, I'm just stopping. I'm never playing again. Can I please stop playing?
Well, on that note, speaking of pumping money into useless things, we are, of course, trying to expand the business here. So we thought that, you know, in case you didn't know, there is a book out. We want you to like that. We want you to like our Instagram page, our Twitter page, and our Facebook page. But we also want you to buy our new product. It's a cologne. And we thought we might put together a little ad for it. Adam Collins coming up after this.
I don't play cricket for results. I don't come to take wickets, score runs, or win games. I play cricket to look good. Rigs, chests, pipes, circuits, salads. This is my domain. So when I hit the sheds, I need to radiate success. That's why I use Chop King Cologne by TGC. With a blend of the finest handcrafted English willow and Kookaburra Red King leather, Chop King Cologne lets me radiate cricket. Whatever the ground, whatever the circuit. Chop King Cologne. The new fragrance for men by TGC. Reek of runs without hitting them.
Well, it's our pleasure to have on the podcast again Adam Collins, one of the best voices in the game, to tell us what's actually happening in cricket. Collo is in Australia now. Last time he joined us, he was in the UK. He's staying close to the cricket over there. I believe he's in North Sydney at the moment following the Women's Ashes. We're going to talk about that. Collo, welcome back to The Great Cricketer. How are you?
G'day, Sam. One, I'm wonderful. It's a very kind introduction. I'm at North Sydney. I just walked past North Sydney Oval number 2, so I'm sure that plenty of great cricket's been played over there over your whole career, wasn't it?
Yes, I've played a little bit, I played a little bit there, and I suppose for background for the listeners, I just spent about 5 minutes describing to Colo a couple of good innings I played at North Sydney number two. Nothing about the bad stuff, though, and there was plenty of that. But let's not go into it. Let's not go into it. Colo, you... you know, your best friends do your PR for you, you know, Colo, but sadly, Dave and Higos can't join us for this interview, so... Let's, you know, do that another time. But, Colo, you are at North Sydney Oval. It's ahead of the Women's Ashes Test. We need to know more about this kind of stuff. Can you just give us a bit of a primer on this test? It's a pink ball test. Australia leads the series 4-2, as far as I understand. If they win, they win the Ashes. Can you just give us a bit of a background on what we can expect heading into this test?
Yeah, sure, no worries. Well, yeah, it is 4-2. It's a multi-format point series, which means the white ball internationals, of which there are 6 3-1-days and 3 T20s, are worth 2 points, and the test match is worth 4. It's the third time they've had a crack at this, where they've played all 3 series for the Women's Ashes Trophy. I think what might be worthwhile, instead of giving you a primer on the Ashes itself, is to say where women's cricket's at to begin with, because the World Cup we had this year was an outrageous success. There were upwards of 50 million people tuned into some version of the World Cup broadcast around the world. It's up to, I think, 150 countries showed it in one way, shape or form or another. So, I mean, it's in a very healthy spot, and the Women's Ashes are a direct extension of that. The TV numbers that came in through Channel 9 during the week, who did the one days, were brilliant as well. The Women's Big Bash League, they're talking about giving that its own isolated window in October during future Australian summers. So it's going great guns, and as I said, this Women's Ashes is an extension of that. Anyone who's followed the women's game for a long time can see like a pronounced improvement in the style of play as well. Both of these sides are fully professional. Australia going professional a couple of years ago in England as well. So as a consequence of that, they're not juggling it with study or part-time jobs or anything like that. Cricket is their life, and it's really had an effect on the product that we're seeing at the moment.
It is wonderful to hear, and being over here in London as well, I very much caught the spirit of the Women's World Cup over here. It was a really excellent tournament. Australia now lead England. I mean, let's talk about winning, Colo. I know before the series...
England.
Yeah, that's right. Hashtag beat England in any format, anywhere, anytime, in any context. You were saying off-air to me a few weeks ago, Colo, that you sort of tipped England. You know, you're close to both sides. You tipped England for this Ashes. Australia lead heading into this test. What can we expect? I mean, who's favourites? You know, who's poised to do damage with the pink ball? Run us through it.
Yeah. It's an interesting question. The neither side have played with the pink ball before. It's the first women's game played under lights in a test match before. They play so little test cricket. The English captain, Heather Knight, said today she's played for England for 7 years for 5 test matches, which gives you a bit of a flavour of that. The last time there was a women's test match was in the August of 2015 in Canterbury. That was a shocker. It was a test match Australia won comfortably, but it was a terrible pitch. And a lot of the sort of the talk around women's cricket is they need to have competitive, fast, bouncy wickets to make sure they get a chance to display their skills and the like. So I think we're going to get that at North Sydney, which should probably favour England a little bit because they've got a stronger pace division. Catherine Brunt and Anya Shrubsole, they're the two. That's the best opening partnership in the world. They've got Kate Cross, who'll probably come in as well as the third seamer. She's got a wonderful test record. Having said that, home soil, being played in Sydney, half the sides from New South Wales. I mean, obviously, that's going to play into it at some stage as well. And I think that Australia do realise, obviously, they only need to win this test match and they'll make the T20s irrelevant because they'll already have an 8-point, well, they would have accrued 8 points, and in a 16-point competition, having the Ashes from 2015, that'll be enough to retain the trophy. So no need for incentive there.
And from a promotional point of view, mate, like I've caught a fair few articles heading into this match. I've seen Mel Jones do a really good piece in The Guardian, also talking about Molly Dive, you know, for whom one of the major, the biggest, most important stand at North Sydney Oval is named after her. She captained the Australian side in her first test match in 1948, scored like a double ton in 180 minutes or something like that. You know, is there, what's the attention like on this match back at home in Australia? I mean, are people getting around this? What are we expecting from a crowd point of view, TV point of view? You know, can you just sort of explain a little bit of that to us?
Yep. Well, it's a bit to unpack there. I think television is not on. Regrettably, Channel 9 aren't showing this. They showed the white ball games and will show the T20s, but this is on a live stream through the Cricket Australia website. So whilst that'll still be in high definition and all the bells and whistles, it's not literally on the box, which may hurt a wee bit. Crowds have been good, decent, considering two of these games were played in Coffs Harbour. with a population of roughly 70,000. I think it is. It's not a bad effort to get a turnout there. The broader interest and promotion is significantly more than 13-14, and I think the main reason behind that is this has been played again as like a primer for the men's Ashes. They've nailed the timing. It's leading. It finishes 2 days before the Brisbane Test match, which means there is a decent amount of coverage being devoted to it, both here and in England. And I, as I mentioned before, I think the World Cup had a lot to do with that. It was probably the first time that women's cricket was on Broadway, as it were. It was in the middle of the year. There was no men's cricket to compete with it, and people were able to sort of devote some attention to learning the game. And I should add, by the way, like, I'm part of that. Like, even though I've been, you know, covering cricket for a while, I only really started investing in women's cricket a couple of years ago, and I was sort of drawn to it pretty strongly when I was, and it's quite common for people. They have loved the game and loved the men's game, and they've came to women's cricket perhaps a little bit later in life, and they realise that going back to watching cricket, which perhaps relies a bit more on technique rather than power, is quite comforting, and I really enjoy it, which isn't to say there isn't power as well. Some of these players have an enormous amount of reach and can clear the pickets on, you know, women's boundaries, men's boundaries, any boundaries, like Nat Sibber, the England all-rounder. She hits it the better part of 80 metres. Likewise, Ashley Gardner, the New South Welshman, she's incredible as well. She's 20 years old. She was the Young Cricketer of the Year this year, and she'll make her debut for Australia in Test cricket tomorrow as well. So there's a nice combination between, I guess, elegance and power.
Yeah, actually, that's a really nice way of putting it. I've watched some women's cricket as well and really enjoyed the focus on technique over power and some of the old ways of understanding cricket. I would say old, you know, I suppose traditional ways is a better word of understanding cricket really does apply to women's cricket for the better, I believe.
And there's probably one more sort of string to that, which is that women's cricket relies on using the pace of the ball, which is there. So by that, what I mean is they play more 360. You see tons of sweeping and reverse sweeping, especially this England side. I spoke to their batting coach last week, and that's kind of their whole philosophy. If we can't ping it down the ground, let's use the pace of the ball, and that's why they all lap and reverse routinely, and they've got it down to a fine art. So it's not a risk-taking shot for them anymore, and that's something that hasn't quite been the case in men's cricket. Men's cricket's still about getting as much bat on it as you can and hoping to clear the rope. Where, like, it's a little subtle differences between men's and women's cricket when you pick up after watching it for a while, which, yeah, can be quite enjoyable.
That's an amazing breakdown, mate, and I really appreciate it. Speaking of clearing the rope, Graham Swann's tried to do that this week with his comments on Ben Stokes. I mean, I know it's all getting a little bit boring, I suppose, but I wonder if that's part of the PR tactics from England here. Swann's come out this week and said that he fully expects Ben Stokes to play in the Ashes if he's not charged after his arrest in Bristol. I know that, you know, there's certain things you can and can't say about it just because it's a police matter, etc. Mm. But Swann's come out anyway and said that he personally thinks Ben will be back and playing in the Ashes. He goes on to say he can't see any reason why not. Oh, I could see a few, but, you know, each to their own. He says if he's not in court, he should be out there. If he's not being charged, then he should be playing for England. He's one of the best players in the world, and he fully expects him to be playing. I mean, is there any part of that where he says he's expecting Stokes to play? Is he revealing a little bit about what he, you know, what might be going on behind the scenes here?
Yeah, well, I can't comment on the case, as you say, but I certainly can comment on the media background to it. And I mean, the Sun story a couple of Saturdays ago, which kind of broke this open with another angle with the two fellas in the club who Stokes allegedly had been protecting at the time. And I don't know, for whatever reason, that seemed to take some of the sting out of this, as you say. It kind of gave the sense there might be some sort of mitigating factor and all the rest of it. And I think that's where Graham's comments directly stem from. It looks as though, well, it doesn't look as though anything. There's been no charges pressed so far. How long has it been? 8-9 weeks now? So if they're going to press charges, that they're going to have to do it soon in order to get them in before the first test in Brisbane. Whether that extends to them chucking him on the Concord and getting into Brisbane at the last minute, so to speak, that's sort of another thing altogether, because as we talked about last time on the show, it isn't just about the legal elements of this. There's also the circus that will ensue if Stokes plays. So he's absolutely right to say that he's one of the best players in the world, and I'm sure there'll be people at ECB HQ who are hatching a plan, but Trevor Bayliss is probably a more worthwhile barometer on this, and his commentary over the weekend, the England coach, was that they don't expect him to come. They're not planning for him to be here, and I think that's kind of case closed as far as the touring party are concerned. But having said that, you couldn't rule out another twist in this story. So far, we've had every possible, you know, connotation and permutation thrown up there, but nothing's actually happened. So we're yet to actually see any formal action, with the exception of him being suspended in the first place.
Colo, an excellent analysis again. Thanks so much for coming on The Grey Cricketer and telling us what's actually going on in the game. How are you finding your return to Australia, having returned from London a few weeks ago?
Oh, brilliant, mate. Well, I did read your book on the way back, actually, which has probably meant my behaviour's regressed significantly. I've really fallen back into old grade cricketer patterns. I want to play. I've been dreaming about cricket. I've been champing everyone. I'm an absolute disgrace. So thanks for that. But apart from that, I'm going well.
Glad. Always happy to provide a service to people to make them feel worse and want to go back and achieve dreams that are dead. Adam Collins, thank you for joining the Great Cricketer Podcast, mate. We'll catch you next time.
My pleasure.
We great cricketers work hard. Everything has to be hard at all times. Work hard. Circuit hard. Just be hard. Never smart. Always hard.
Hard yakker indeed. Pez here with a quick note about what you're going to hear. This is not our normal interview format, but it is a very special one. A few weeks ago, I had the chance to have a few beers with Dan Norcross, who's one of the best commentators in world cricket. He's with BBC Test Match Special. I kind of think he's like the Stephen Fry of cricket in many ways. I don't know what that means to him. He's probably offended by it. Nevertheless, it's part of an ongoing series. It's loosely called the Overseas Pro at the moment, but if you guys have better ideas, then please let me know. The chat went for a significant period of time, but don't worry, it's been edited. It doesn't go for that long, but you will note that it jumps around for that reason. With that in mind, I hope you enjoy the chat with Dan Norcross. It's called the Overseas Pro, but also tell me if it should be called something else. Well, to everybody listening, welcome to the Overseas Pro, a new venture on behalf of the Great Cricketers and me, Sam Perry. Many of you will have heard that I'm over here in London and essentially just feeling left out as far as I'm concerned. So I'm going to do a few one-on-ones with people over here who are interesting. The man who sits opposite me is, he's intimidating, and you'll soon find out why, because what I'm doing with him is exactly what he does and more for his role. I'm talking about Dan Norcross, commentary member of BBC TMS Test Match Special. For those who don't know, he's about to go over to the Ashes to commentate on Australia versus England. He's just lighting up a cigarette as he does this now, as I talk now, a rock and roll star without doubt. And for those who don't know BBC TMS, it's the preeminent commentary team in the world, I would say, globally. You're happy with that?
Yeah, I'm happy with that. Yeah.
Extremely prestigious, kind of similar to Grandstand, but just with that English superiority, I would say.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to really be upset with that description. It's I don't know how accurate it is, but it's that's a nice way of overblowing me.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm very happy with that.
Very good. That's part of the setup. I mean, you're the king, Dan, of painting pictures. We are sitting here in Tooting Bec, which is kind of your neck of the woods. We're in a pub called the Wheat Chaff. You may hear some of the whirring sounds of some generator or other, or maybe police cars going past.
Yeah, there'll be a few of those. We're Tooting.
Yeah. So the sound isn't perfect, but listeners should be used to that. Can you describe the scene around us otherwise, though, Dan? I mean, tell us about Tooting Bec. Tell us about this area.
Well, I mean, what we see here is a very plucky attempt to remain reasonable amidst the miserable decay that is autumn in England, where death is all around us, darkness starts to envelop us in a gloomy fashion. Crepuscular light will soon be upon us, and something close to a very morbid depression will take grip of this septic isle. I want you to understand that there is something that I deeply resent about all of you, which is that when your country was discovered, not by your indigenous people, but by my more immediate forebears in the 18th century, I have no idea why it was that we didn't just place a wall around Britain and leave the convicts in and then go and escape to Australia. Because for some bizarre reason, we turned down the opportunity to live in a gigantic island that's filled with gold and tin and copper and stuff, which you've only just discovered, has to be said, the last 20 years. Nobody bothered digging around in Australia until recently.
That's right.
You were all ridiculously impoverished until someone went, hey, has anyone actually bothered looking underground? And lo and sodding behold, there are riches and there's warmth and there's being able to be outdoors all the time and play cricket and as a result, be better. I think that there should be a handicap system in cricket. That if in England, as you know, Sam, from having been here now for long enough, in reality you can be outside for about 66 days a year, if you're lucky, right? And in Australia, you can be outside for the best part of, what, about 280?
Yeah, depending on where you are, yeah.
I kind of think, you know, I'm not going to do it on a one-to-one basis, but I do think that England should start every test match with a 150-run advantage per innings. So I'd created this incredibly elaborate dice game in which, you know, every conceivable form of extra and every conceivable form of dismissal was available to you.
It's an early version of being able to put your own team in, name into FIFA or something like that, right?
It is.
More
but the thing
Dan Norcross's dice cricket.
If you're rolling the die, you see, and you're doing John Arlen, you go, so here comes Lily, he comes steaming in from the Vauxhall and Norcross is facing. And you rolled a two and he goes back into his crease and plays it out into the offside and there's no run. The crowd's getting most energised now as the sun pokes out behind the clouds. Here's Lily again, his shirt billowing in the breeze. Norcross waiting intent. So you roll a six and you're still talking. And so then you get to roll again if it's six. Five. Oh, yes, roll again and it's four. And he's cracked it through the covers for four. And Lily kicks the turf with frustration as Norcross moves into the 90s. You know, and so you'd sort of. You were doing all that. It was ridiculous. I mean, thinking about it, I was probably actually mentally ill. I mean, you know, I mean, mercifully, it was the 70s, so no one talked about mental illness then. You know, my mother would just come upstairs, she'd hear me whittering and think, oh, God, what have we done? Why didn't we abort him?
For a cricketer, the great moment is to get the call from, well, today it would be, in Australian terms, you know, Rod Marsh saying, son, you're going to play for Australia. In commentary terms, that's probably, you know, you're with us on the BBC, it might be a little bit of a slower process where you're kind of eased in to the team. How do you become a commentator at the top level?
I have no idea. I mean, I can try to describe my own experiences. We set up something called Test Match Sofa, and the idea was that people, male, female, middle-aged, young, old, balding, mostly overweight, who loved their cricket. Don't forget, I also played cricket and was captain of cricket team, so I knew lots and lots of people who loved their cricket. We would do ball-by-ball commentary, but with none of the restrictions that you'd have being a proper broadcaster, because we're on the internet, and this meant that I could drink as much as I wanted, I could smoke constantly, I could shout at Kevin Peterson for playing a switch hit, I could, where I felt it warranted it, swear at Ricky Ponting, I could, you know, let off steam. It got to be popular enough that the Cricketer magazine bought it and then put it on a more sure footing and paid me a salary, and then I realised I was actually doing this professionally. So it's a very roundabout way of answering your question. I mean, I suppose I became a cricket commentator. I became a cricket commentator when I was 7. I then became a cricket commentator again when I was 40.
Yeah.
And then I became a cricket commentator again when I was 44. And they were all very, very different sort of ways of doing it.
The way you've come through to commentary is something I think people will find really interesting, because there's a huge conversation about that in Australia at the moment, and you may be loath to talk about it for the forces that you've just described earlier, but commentary in Australia, it's probably the same in England, but it's a sort of thing where everybody, it means a lot to a lot of people because it's the soundtrack to the things that you care about. And there's been a huge discussion in the last couple of years about some of our more higher profile commentators or commentary teams, etc. I'm talking about Channel 9 and even, you know, Grandstand, the ABC, etc. It garners a lot of opinion, as I said, because people care about it. And you seem to have had this passage through the commentary based on repetition, based on a little bit of enterprise, based on humour, and now you find yourself in the most prestigious commentary box of all.
Yeah.
And it doesn't surprise me that you have sort of, well, it's probably 10 years hard, 40 years hard work, overnight success, but have gone straight to the top there. Do you see yourself as a new wave of commentator?
No, I don't actually. I don't see it like that, because you can only be what you are. There was a piece of advice Henry Blofeld gave me, which didn't surprise me, and I found very easy to maintain, actually. which is that you must always be yourself. And the moment you start thinking that you are representing other people in what you do, or that you've got some higher purpose, and therefore you start thinking and analyzing how you commentate, is the moment you won't sound natural anymore, you won't be believable, and people, because people need to engage with broadcast voices, they need to believe that the person they're listening to is real, you know, that you can instantly tell a phony, you know. The styles of commentary I find more irksome are self-congratulatory and banterish and closed, you know, where essentially you're listening to two ex-cricketers who are mates of each other, remembering incidents that they had with each other while doing commentary. I find that that's quite excluding of people.
You mentioned there before, I still have a few things I want to find out from you though. You mentioned before visualising the first test in Brisbane and what you might see. I mean, tell our listeners what you're expecting to see in Brisbane or in Australia, and how that might marry with what you would like to see.
Right.
In Brisbane and Australia. I mean, the Dan Norcross show is coming to Australia. What do you want?
It's a voyage of discovery for me, because I've only been to Australia once in 1998. So I think if I'm honest with myself, what I'm expecting to see is a touring side struggle, especially if it doesn't have Ben Stokes, and especially if Australia's fast bowlers stay fit. So if Cummins and Stark and Hazelwood play four of the five games, then I think England will find it very, very difficult, and I think there's a really serious danger of the juggernaut approach, much has happened to England against India in the winter there. They're both environments, Australia and India, where you struggle to come back when you get behind. The demons set in, you start thinking you're up against the whole nation. The Australians have a fantastic way of being incredibly dismissive. So, you know, once you've lost one game, you hear so much about how utterly pathetic and hopeless you are. And I mean, I don't know how many sides have been the worst side ever to tour Australia. It's pretty much every side that loses in Australia is the worst side ever to come to Australia. And
that was sort of a bit of early Bill Laurie.
Early Bill, yeah. Tony?
Can I challenge that just a little bit, though, Dan? Because
of course.
I suspect that you're doing a very... we're talking about... cultures here, you're doing a very British thing and being very kind of magnanimous and talking England down. I'm sure that when you guys sit down among yourselves and discuss all, you know, how we're all animals in Australia, etc., and there's a lot of things we need to learn about politeness, I'm sure there's a small part of you saying, let these guys talk, let them build themselves up around hostility and the way they're going to sort of win via hyper-aggression, all that sort of stuff. And you just watch sort of Root and Cook. I mean, surely those things are in your dreams. You just sort of, you think maybe Jimmy will have a good series. Australia are a little bit vulnerable. Mm. I think that's what you guys actually think. There's a deathly silence around English cricket at the moment.
Like that Star Trek animal, where the harder you hit it, the more it absorbs that it takes the power on and becomes that much stronger.
There's a dormant hope there in English cricket at the moment.
Look, every Englishman will and woman will go to bed at night hoping that what you have to say is right, and so it could get ugly quickly. Frankly, I mean, obviously that will upset me hugely, but I'll make a lot more money in Australia working on Australian radio and TV with a bit of luck if Australia are winning, because no one wants a smug toff from Britain telling up saying, yes, I'm terribly sorry your chaps lost the last game. What they want is a human piñata. Hi, okay, Dan, so you come from this most shitty little country, England. Your guys are totally bloody hopeless. They've lost again. How do you feel?
I love that when you put the Australian accent on, you lose your baritone somehow.
Well, we're going to go, hi. Aussie accents, me, hi, they're up here, you know. Oh, no, I can't do the deep Aussie. Yeah. I can't do the growl. Yeah. It's tough.
It's not bad.
So, yeah, I mean, there are swings and roundabouts.
So it works for you professionally if Australia is going well.
Yeah, I'm saying that.
You can be the pinata.
I say that slightly flippantly, yeah. But, you know, I mean, Australians are much happier when they're winning. And they enjoy...
That's all we have.
Yeah, and you're magnificently graceless winners as well. So
you
love to rub it in. And as luck would have it, because I spent many of my formative years, you know, from 1989 to 2005, I was 20 to 36 years old.
Yeah.
And I learnt a lot about losing in that time as an England fan against Australia. So it's not like at the age of 48, I'm going to be absolutely devastated if England were to lose the Ashes. So I'm very happy if people pay me money while they humiliate me publicly. I mean, that's fine. The rivalry that England and Australia have is pantomime. It's wonderful. You know, I'm going to be brutally honest with you, and I don't like to admit it, I really, really like Australians, and I loved being in Australia. And it pains me to say it. I do. I find them, they have my kind of sense of humour. I like them.
This might be the last question, but tell me about what I understand to be your cricketing hero.
Yeah.
Who is your cricketing hero and why?
Well, he's not just my cricketing hero. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, he's cricketing, political, emotional, educational, moral tutor. Is a man who often misunderstood, as a lot of people think he's Scottish, and he's not. He's as English as they come, really. And he's the great Douglas Robert Jardine, who, when faced with one of the greatest dangers to world cricket, which was Donald Braddon, flat track bully, obviously ridiculously good at batting, decided that there had to be a way, found a way, won, you know, and then got pilloried for it. And also
unfairly, in your view.
Very well, hugely unfairly. I mean, it exposed one of the funnier aspects of Australian behaviour, which is that Australians, I think even more than the British, I mean, every nation does it to a degree, but and everybody does it to a degree, but the projection is so hilarious, because ever since Bodyline, the English have been accused of being whinging poms. And of course, the people who invented whinging were the Australians, because it was them that were complaining about an English team playing within the laws of cricket.
It was just a bit of short stuff, really.
Just a bit of short stuff. And, you just see him off. Stan McCabe got 180-odd against him. I mean, he didn't have any problem. And then when the Aussies went completely berserk because Bert Oldfield top-edged a pull, it wasn't even a hook, top-edged a pull around about waist height into his own face. I mean, you can't blame Larwood for him using the edge of his bat. Absolutely hilarious. And it gave us the great Woodfall line. There's only one team out there playing cricket. You know, you hear the tears rolling down the cheeks. What's happened to cricket?
It's always Bill Laurie.
It's always Bill Laurie, yeah. Oh, I bet Woodfall actually did have quite a deep voice. It was partly to have the guts to go and do that, but also because of the way he stood by his players, and the way he treated Harold Larwood at a time when, you know, there was a massive class divide. And the fact that he stuck by his principles and stuck to his guns, and the fact that he was so treated so abysmally and was then replaced by the quisling traitor Gubby Allen, who went to Australia in 36-7 as England's captain. And England won the first two games, and I'm convinced to this day, and mercifully everybody who played in it is now dead so I can't be sued, that they chucked the last three games because of the danger of a diplomatic incident, which was appeasement in my view. I mean, it was, and Britain had got previous with appeasement in the 30s, as we know. Gubby Allen would have been right there wiping Hitler's arse, I'm sure, if he'd been given the opportunity. So, to me, Douglas Jardine represented everything that was good, worthwhile, and properly British. And he wound up the Australians really badly. And the thing that I spotted the Australians doing so well throughout my lifetime is it's not, everyone says, oh, they're rude and they're uncouth and this and the other. I don't see them like that. I think they're really good at winding up the British. And if you fall for it, you're an idiot.
With that in mind, Dan, thanks for being the first guest on this, whatever this thing is, and wishing you the best in Australia as well. And, Dan's put the call out. Guys, to anyone listening, he wants to be the target. So give it to him, I think. But also listen in to BBC TMS, one of the great commentators, Dan Norcross.
Thank you very much. You won't be able to miss me because I'll be wearing a T-shirt which has got the entire innings for Australia against England at Trent Bridge that appeared in a tweet where you were all out for 60, and it appears on my T-shirt. And I should be wearing that, well, at least for the first day of the first Test match, and then after that I might have to burn it. Thank you.
Cheers, Dan. That's great, mate. That's great.
Are you upset that no one comes to watch you play cricket? Are you tired of no one appreciating you for the talented third grader you are? The Cricket Family is the first program dedicated to helping people like you feel relevant again. We have a database of over 1,000 out-of-work actors who can come to your games and masquerade as your friend, girlfriend, wife, parents, or grandparents, helping you create the perception that the people close to you actually care about what you do.
Oh, great shot, Jason.
No, I'm proud of you, son.
The Cricket Family, helping cricketers feel relevant once again.
Fantastic to hear there from Sam in London and Daniel Norcross, and also Adam Collins as well. I almost called him Colo, but I don't want to get too colloquial on this podcast, even at this late stage, so thanks for tuning in. Hashtag AskTGC. It's probably the favourite time of the week for you. It's a favourite time of the week for me. I don't know why it'd be the favourite time in your week. That's sad for you. Matt Trodden uses the hashtag AskTGC, gentlemen, and he says, how does a former grade leaguey deal with being belted around in a return to park cricket on postage stamp grounds?
Yeah, this was one that came in a couple of days ago. He goes, and we did reply by inviting him to explore three free counselling sessions that the government offers through Medicare. Don't ask me why I know about that. Also, let's not make fun of that too much. But also, I mean, sometimes you can read into the premise of the question, and I think there is an identity problem, Matt. I do know Matt, actually, but it's an identity problem. You're referring to yourself as a former grade leggy, and maybe you were just a park leggy with respect. So you know, the fact that you bowled a ball of leg spin in grade cricket is actually the worst thing that you could have done, because it's giving you identity issues since. Also, leg spin is the worst art ever, unless you're Shane Warne.
That's funny, actually, because I did actually bowl one ball of leg spin in grade cricket, and my figures remained for 7 years, 0.1 overs, none for four. So, and I, to be fair, but I never identified myself as a leg spin bowler in grade cricket.
You should never do that.
So, some sports nuffy writes in, which sounds like I'm sledging him, but that is actually his Twitter name. And he says, at grade cricket, I've got a few last week. Dad has called me twice in 2 days. Are runs the currency for love, or am I reading too much into them? Ask TGC.
No, you never can be reading too far into anything, some sports nuffy. Look, runs, I think they are the currency for love. And that suits me, but I would say that if runs are the only currency, then I'm absolutely fucked if they do an audit. I'd like to know more about the calls, though, boys. The calls from the dad, what are they? Are they cricket-related? Are they life-related? Yep. What's dad talking to you about? Yep. Basically, I want to know what you're talking about with your dad in order to answer this question.
Yeah. I mean, this is interesting because Justin Langer referred to this in his book, The Power of Passion, written in the late 2000s or mid 2000s. He also wrote in one of the captions of a picture, you know, you always go straight to the pictures in these books. And I don't know why I know this, but he said runs are the only currency of any value. And he actually didn't finish that off by saying in cricket or in the game. He must have meant in life. Yeah. So
he's a big investor in Bitcoin.
Yeah. Maybe runs are Bitcoin. Yeah. Okay.
Runs at Bitcoin. Nothing means anything at some sports, Nuffy. Andrew Donison writes in and he says, what is the perfect thing to bring for afternoon tea? Is it 1, barbecue shapes, 2, barbecue shapes, or 3, last week's barbecue shapes? Dave, thoughts?
Am I the only one here who genuinely doesn't like shapes? Like, why did shapes become the default kind of go-to crisp bread brand for grade cricketers? There's so many other options out there.
Yeah. It might be Freudian, you know, cutting shapes on the circuit or bowling shapes, some shape.
Yeah.
Just the word shape is part of the lexicon, I'm guessing.
Is it just also, like, it's the cheapest? Yeah, it does stick out on a shelf, doesn't it? Good branding. That's probably what gets grade cricketers, very visual people. I was a big fan of chicken crimpies. Yeah. I know that's a pop.
Oh, yeah, crimpies.
Yep, I don't know either. Paul Zelenardo, I've definitely pronounced that incorrectly. I apologise, Paul. Hello, at Grey Cricketer. There is an A-League player named Joey Champness. Views on this, please. Pez, Joey Champness.
I've included that in the run sheet and seen Dave shake his head, and that's pretty much all I needed, to be honest. That's my view on it. Just wanted to introduce the term champion again, just to
shaking my head
feel
on a podcast.
That blackness that we all feel with the word champ. But I guess he's the champ. No one would champ him.
Lads, Jordan Wright has got back to us after a tweet that one of you two posted, because it wasn't me. He said, clubs now have academies where youngsters learn about the third net, casual alcoholism and being lightly pressured into post-match nudity. So Jordan asks, give in and secure your spot or stay clothed and risk social isolation. Great cricketer, any advice?
Oh, God.
One of the great questions. Like, I think every person who's played grade cricket has been confronted with this.
Mm. Yeah.
Because really getting nude in the shower, like in the dressing room, says so much about where your social capital and your social status is going to be in any grade team.
Yeah.
And it's a particularly difficult thing, I would imagine, if you have a small penis.
Give in and secure your spot. It sounds like Harvey Weinstein, that phrase. It's definitely a Weinstein quote. Look, I'd recommend that. What's his name? Sorry, I can't see who the person's
Jordan.
Name was. Jordan.
Jordan, right. Jordan.
I mean, I'd recommend that if this is a serious question, I would recommend that he does get nude, but you can still maintain a certain dignity in that nudity. Like, you don't have to linger in the showers afterwards or, you know, do any of that kind of weird stuff. You can just literally just get in, clean yourself, avoid eye contact, and then get out. Make sure your towel is within reaching distance at all times. You can still just have a shower, and I think that will help with your career. But if you are actively avoiding the shower and being seen to do so, people are going to ask questions, and word will carry to the selection table.
I think absolutely, Dave. Yeah, hide in plain sight is my advice, because like probably the worst thing you can do is like either shower in shorts or your underwear, because it stands out. And so hiding in plain sight by just being naked around 10 other blokes, you know, just completely normal, that's the best thing that you can do to advance not only cricket career, but your professional life.
Can we just stick with the shower thing? Because I think a lot of people will be listening closely for some advice on this. Like, it's a really strange thing as to where, like, there's a lot going on with people's eyes in the dressing room after the match, but like when it comes to showers, because on the one hand, you're not meant to make eye contact with people, but on the other hand, everyone is watching everyone to see what they do with showers without looking specifically at their genitals or anything. Like, you can be sure that when you've showered, everybody has seen whether you have what your penis looks like. Let's really get to it, because if it's a very large penis, you'll then, you know, have a reputation for that, and that will become your sole identity. Is this? I mean, you're laughing. He goes, "Do I sound perverted here, or am I going to be on my own with this?" Because that's been my experience. Like, although it's never been a problem for people who have that situation, because they tend to own it a lot, as you would. They? But if you try and hide, people will notice that as well. If you don't shower, people will notice that. So everyone's noticing everything you do without particularly looking at you.
Well, mate.
You've just summed up grade cricket right there.
I think this is part of the greatest demise that is grade cricket, because people don't shower anymore. Like because grade cricket is becoming younger and younger, and now that like the young people in society outweigh the older people in the club changing room, now, like, the young kids, they don't shower. They don't want to shower in front of their colleagues. And, I mean, as strange as that may sound, that sentence, but, like, it just doesn't happen anymore. And, like, you know, some of the greatest bonding experiences happen in the shower. It's where, like, you know, you see, like, an old man sitting in a chair naked, you know, having a beer. It's where, you know, you get to judge people for the pubic that they've assorted that week for the Saturday night circuit. You know, all these things are great male bonding experiences. Christ.
It was going so well, he goes.
I broke down because I couldn't take the things that I was saying seriously anymore. But yeah, seriously, like, you know, people like they don't shower anymore. Great cricket showers are becoming even danker.
I always found it funny that, like, you wouldn't see certain club volunteers all day, but as soon as the showers go on, they're suddenly all in the change room. There's nothing that attracts, you know, 50 plus age club
camera.
Volunteers, male, than the showers.
It's always good sailing close to the wind. You were saying that it's a great male bonding experience, and that the fact is young people aren't showering. I mean, there must be a reason for that. Perhaps young people are waking up to the idea that not only is there great club bonding experiences or male bonding experiences, there's probably also sexual harassment as well. And maybe they just don't want that anymore.
Yeah.
Mate, I reckon legitimately it's because of, like, they feel much higher, like, body image issues because of social media. Like, legitimately, that's why I think they're like, you know, they feel like they have to look like, you know, fitness models on Instagram, basically, to feel confident with taking their shirt off in the showers. Whereas, obviously, like, when we played in the 90s, early 2000s, you know, like, it was, like, obviously the character in our book, Nugsy, he just loves being naked, and he's got the worst rig of all, but he's strong. And, you know, so that's like... I don't know. It's just a theory. I think we went on the massive tangent there.
Yeah, it's just a theory.
What did Jordan ask? Something about tea.
Right. No, it's important conversations. Yeah, Jordan, don't take your clothes off if you don't want to, mate.
All right, let's roll on. Joel Stewart says, what is the most yuck of the following three scenarios? A keeper wearing short sleeves, batting pads and a bucket Terry toweling hat. Two, a medium pace bowler coming off a 15-plus step run-up wearing his cap backwards and servo sunnies. Oh, Christ.
Oh, my God.
Three, a batsman that never wore gloves and played in a white short sleeve business shirt. I ask this because all three scenarios were on display weekly back at my cricket club on the far south coast of New South Wales. As soon as I moved to Sydney and played grade, I realised just how utterly fucked this is. Hashtag not grade cricket. Good question.
Oh, well, yeah. It's a really good question, Joel, and I really appreciate your attention to detail. Just going through these ones. So one, a keeper wearing short sleeves, batting pads and a Terry toweling hat. Yes, it's shocking, but it's semi-plausible. Mm. Short sleeve keeping stuff, it's absolutely terrible, but it's semi-plausible. Medium pace bowler off of... Yeah, go on, Higo.
Sorry, Pez. I just noticed, looking at the highlights from England's match against the WA11, that Johnny Bairstow wicket-keeping in a Greg Chappell hat, for lack of a better phrase, and it's just all sorts of yuck.
That's just a sun protection mechanism. Sure, like, yeah, because the English guys get very worried.
He's very
when they come
fair.
Out.
He's very fair, Johnny.
I mean, it's functional, but you know,
I don't
so
think it excuses
condom.
It. But like, yeah, exactly. I don't think it excuses it at all. He goes, and then so you got a medium pace bowler coming off 15-plus step run up. I just like that added detail.
Yeah,
wearing his cap backwards and servo sunnies, and I like that he has servo sunnies as though. If he sort of had some premium sunnies, it might be a little bit more plausible. Mm. Again, I can, you know, you see people wearing their cap backwards bowling in the net, so it's semi-plausible. Mm. Like, I think the worst is the batsman that never wore gloves, like never wore gloves, not just in that match. Well, I guess that might have been a Bradman thing too, and played in a white short sleeve business shirt. Now, this is what I want to know about, the white short sleeve business shirt. Yeah. Why is it short sleeve? That's is that Mormonism? Which, again, no religious discrimination, but who has a white short sleeve business shirt unless... That
there's no
your,
such thing. There's no
face.
Such thing as a short white short sleeve business shirt.
Not a business That's shirt. Not a thing. There are casual kind of button up white short sleeve shirts that people do use, you know, when conducting business. But it's not a proper business shirt. I know because I've got one and I plan on wearing it during the summer months here in Sydney at work. But to be honest, out of those three, I mean, the gloves one is obvious. But I just think the sight of a medium pace bowler running up with his cap backwards and servo sunnies in, you know, the far south coast of New South Wales, that is disgusting. And I'm not surprised this bloke moved to Sydney, just to get away from that on a weekly basis, because that is just utterly fucked.
Lads, in the interest of time, I'm just going to roll through the next two. Sam Ty writes in a couple of weeks ago and he said, how much kit have you had to return to Ed Cowan after his segment on the show last week was used as ammo to drop him? Fair question. And then MJ Noster says, at Grey Cricketer, be good or fuck off, third book title. I mean, it's certainly in contention at the moment. Pez, I'll let you ask the last question before we wrap up the show this week.
This is a lot. I really like this question, boys. I wanted to read it out to you and get your views on it. It's from Ace241394. Doesn't sound like a spy at all. Dear TGC, so just bear with me here. Dear TGC, upon listening to the first couple of podcasts this season, my suspicions have been confirmed that your contribution to cricket goes beyond portraying and championing a rare and perhaps slowly dying subculture in our society, but rather aims to heighten its awareness by poking fun at its absurdity. This anti-cricket movement draws very distinct parallels to the French artist Marcel Duchamp, or Duchamp, whose work during the World War I era was criticised at the time for being anti-art, but later went on to become regarded as the most influential contribution to art in the 20th century, and Duchamp himself has often been referred to as the father of postmodernism. In becoming the fathers of cricket postmodernism, does this sit well with you at all? Discuss. Hashtag Ask TGC. PS, love the show, guys. Hope this gets mentioned. We'll give you some gloves.
I'm fucking stoked with the gloves, first off. Thanks, Ace.
Yeah. That is very good. That's a very good question. It does sit very well with me. I'm not sure about you guys, but this is a huge compliment, really, to what we do or what we strive to be doing over the years. So when I saw this one come in, I actually did you know, it intrigued me because I wasn't aware of Deschamps or Duchamp or however Marcel pronounces his last name, probably Deschamps. And I found out that he even though he is considered the father of the well-known art movements in some respects, he hated painting. He just absolutely hated it. He didn't want to make works of art that produced any kind of aesthetic experience or even an intellectual experience. He was just interested in ideas, not visuals, which obviously goes against the grain of everything we know about cricket, which is that looking good is all that matters. He did not care for that. He didn't want a bar of that. And all I can think is that maybe off the back of this, we should be curating some kind of conceptual art exhibition based on grim grade cricket experience.
Maybe we already are. This just is a postmodern art exhibition. God. Or maybe we just talk about getting nude in the showers. You decide.
It's all art. Art installation.
Pez, any thoughts on Ace's question?
No, that was pretty much it. Like, I think if you're part of postmodernism, then you can't really say that you greatly love that quote or what Ace has written, and you've got it framed on your wall, and you show it to your wife and your dad, and say, "See, there's actual meaning behind this." You don't do that. You just say, "Thanks, champ. I don't get it." What a rare question. That's fucking rare.
Guys, it's been an absolutely wonderful show this week. Thanks as ever to the fans for tuning in each week. We really appreciate it. We'd love this very much if you could be so kind to take 30 seconds out of your day to review this on iTunes. That really helps us. It's been an absolute shock and a pleasure for us to get as high as number one on the charts in Australia. We fucking love making this show, and we love all the feedback that we get for it. There's a book out. You can get it. Actually, people have been really good using the hashtag ThanksCricket with pictures of the book. That's awesome. We really love that as well. Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, we're all on it. Tell your mates. See you next week.